We are in Numbers chapter 10, about to leave Sinai. Been there since nine chapters less than two books ago, Exodus 19. And it's been 13 months that they've been there, plus a few days, and they're getting ready to go. There's one last final thing to do in getting ready, and that comes in chapter 10. That is after, at the end of chapter 9, it details how the cloud moved and settled, and whether it stayed a day, you know, overnight, or several days, or a longer time, the people of Israel would camp there. So let's see, verse 23, at the command of the Lord, they camped, and at the command of the Lord, they set out. They kept the charge of the Lord at the command of the Lord by Moses. And then we go into chapter 10, which we'll read a little ways along, and then I had to turn to my Jewish Publication Society translation for some help on some of this. And I'll let you know what that is. So verse 1, the Lord spoke to Moses saying, verse 2.
Make two silver trumpets of hammered work, you shall make them, and you shall use them for summoning the congregation and for breaking camp.
Okay, and there's two things there, summoning the congregation, breaking camp. So you begin to wonder, almost immediately, how do you distinguish between the two? Verse 3. And when both are blown, all the congregation shall gather themselves to you at the entrance of the tent of the of meeting. Verse 4.
But if they blow only one, then the chiefs, the heads of the tribes of Israel, shall gather themselves to you.
Okay, that's two distinct patterns. Verse 5. When you blow an alarm, the camps that are on the east side shall set out. That's 3. Verse 6.
When you sound the advance the second time, then the camps that lie on the south side shall begin their journey. They shall sound the call for them to begin their journeys.
Okay. Verse 7. But when the assembly is to be gathered together, you shall blow a long blast, but you shall not sound an alarm. Okay, this is getting a little confusing. Verse 8.
And the sons of Aaron, the priests, shall blow the trumpets. The trumpet shall be to you for a perpetual statute throughout your generations.
Perpetual statute. Okay. Verse 9.
So the trumpets are a law.
Well, a statute is different than law.
Oh, okay.
It's a regulatory thing. This is an established pattern. A pattern established by God.
Okay.
Let's see. Verse 9. And when you go to war in your land against the adversary who oppresses you, then you shall sound an alarm with the trumpets, that you may be remembered before the Lord your God, and you shall be saved from your enemies. Okay. And then verse 10.
Also in the day of your gladness, in your appointed feasts, and at the beginning of your months, you shall blow the trumpets over your burnt offerings and over the sacrifices of your peace offerings, and they shall be a memorial for you before your God. I am the Lord your God.
Who brought you out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery, right?
Right.
Okay. So then I started looking in the commentary, and in the Lutheran Study Bible, trying to figure out the difference between the soundings of the trumpet for different things. And I got to the Jewish Publication Society, Hebrew English Tanakh, and here's how it goes. Starting out in verse 3, when both are blown in long blasts, the whole company shall assemble before you at the entrance of the tent of meeting. And if only one is blown, the chieftains, heads of Israel's contingent shall assemble before you. But when you sound short blasts, the divisions encamped on the east shall move forward. And when you sound short blasts a second time, those encamped on the south shall move forward. Thus, short blasts shall be blown for setting them in motion. While to convoke the congregation, you shall blow long blasts, not short ones. The trumpets shall be blown by Aaron's sons, the priests. They shall be for you an institution for all time throughout the ages. When you are at war in your land against an aggressor who attacks you, you shall sound short blasts on the trumpets that you may be remembered before the Lord your God and be delivered from your enemies. And on your joyous occasions, your fixed festivals and new moon days, you shall sound the trumpets over your burnt offerings and your sacrifices of well-being. They shall be a reminder of you before your God. I am the Lord. I the Lord, am your God. So, in the Hebrew wording, there was a distinction between long blasts, short blasts, and the difference of meaning. The long blasts were to gather people together. The short blasts were to set out. When the short blasts were sounded, when they were going to war, that was a reminder to God how he would rise and lead the people forward in their journeys. So it was a call to God to go before them into battle. The long blasts were for the gathering together, the short blasts again for setting out. That became something that I started digging and never found an answer to this one, because there is a connection in the New Testament between this passage and something that is said in the New Testament. Anybody want to guess what that is that's said in the New Testament?
And the trumpet shall sound.
Revelations.
I went to 1 Thessalonians 4, verse 16. For the Lord himself will descend from heaven with a cry of command, with the voice of an archangel, and with the sound of the trumpet of God. And the dead in Christ will rise first. So my question that I never got an answer to, I'm still looking, it may take some years, eventually it'll surface, eventually we'll find out, that sounding of the trumpet, is it a long blast or short blasts? Is it a summoning to gather, or is it a call to rise and get moving? Any thoughts?
Well, the Halal Fellowship, which is a Jewish Christian Jewish Messianic Jews, says the final trumpet blast will summon his people to resurrection and war against evil. So
that doesn't give an answer.
But if they're summoning, it'd be the long blast, wouldn't it?
And if it was a command to muster the people of God and move, then it would be short blast.
Right. No, it doesn't give an answer.
No, there. We'll find out. But notice also what the trumpets are made of and what they are not made of.
They're silver.
And they are not?
They're not ram's horns.
They're not ram's horns. Because the ram's horn is used to call to remembrance the Passover, the lamb, forgiveness, and being called the people of God. The silver trumpets are to summon, to muster, and to move.
My translation, if you go in, First Thessalonians 4, verse 17, says, after that, we who are still alive and are left will be caught up together with them in the cloud to meet the Lord in the air.
Mm-hmm.
So wouldn't that imply that it was a meeting as opposed to a coming together, as opposed to going to war?
The summoning together or yes. The
meeting with God in the cloud.
But then there's the possibility that the call could be, let all God's people now set out. And the setting out could be going into the eternal kingdom. And there is a bit of that journey aspect to that. So I am just completely in between the possibilities, and either theme could be entering in there in Thessalonians. Besides which, and this is the other fascinating part to the Thessalonians passage. Yeah, I turned away from it. How does Paul lead into that? He says, verse 15, for this we declare to you by a word from the Lord, that we who are alive, who are left until the coming of the Lord, precede those who have fallen asleep. Which, a word from the Lord in Paul is at least a little bit ambiguous, because it can mean a revelation that has been given to the church at that time, or it can mean Paul's studious sifting through Old Testament passages. And Paul the rabbi does not show his work all the time, as my algebra teacher used to say. Does not show his work. And we are left to try and figure out where to get that from. There is one aspect of Paul not showing his work that, well, has, it's where Paul says that if Israel turning away meant salvation to the Gentiles, what will their returning be but resurrection from the dead? Where does Paul get that? And after hunting on that for about 30 years, apparently that is from the tail end of Moses' sermon in Deuteronomy, where he details the future of God's people, that they will turn away, be scattered, everything will go out to the Gentiles, and then from the far distant places where they've been, they will hear God's call and in their hearts turn back to him. End of sermon. And Paul apparently is taking that to be the charting of the future history of Israel. So Paul doesn't show his work and leaves us to deal with it. And that's about where we need to leave this. I'm using a TV remote to hold my book open because it wants to close. Shall we go back to Numbers, chapter 10? It's time to leave. Verse 11, in the second year, in the second month, on the 20th day of the month, the cloud lifted from over the tabernacle of the testimony. And just to set this in context, in the first year, in the first month, on the 15th day of the month, they set out from Egypt. So it is a 1 year, 1 month, 5 days since Exodus chapter 13. Yeah. 1 year, 1 month, 5 days. Verse 12, somebody.
Then the Israelites set out from the desert of Sinai and traveled from place to place until the cloud came to rest in the desert of Paran?
Paran. Your choice of how you pronounce it. Dalich, the straight and shortest way from Sinai to Kadesh on the southern border of Canaan was only a journey of 11 days. But that's for a person traveling alone or with a small group. A few months after leaving Sinai, the Israelites had already arrived at Kadesh. So this is a very short journey. Verse 13. They set out for the first time at the command of the Lord by Moses. Verse 14.
The standard of the camp of the people of Judah set out first by their companies, and over their company was Nashon, the son of Amminadab.
Yeah, good. And over the company of the tribe of the people of Issachar was Nathanael, son of Zuar. I just keep going. And over the company of the tribe of the people of Zebulun was Eliab, the son of Helon. Verse 17, And when the tabernacle was taken down, the sons of Gershon and the sons of Merari, who carried the tabernacle, set out. Verse 18.
And the... And when the tabernacle was taken down, the sons of Gershon and the sons of Merari, who carried the tabernacle, set out, and that the standard of the camp of Reuben set out by their companies, and over their company was Eleazar, the son of Sheduar.
And over the company of the tribe of the people of Simeon was Shelumiel, the son of Zurishaddai. And over the company of the tribe of the people was Eliasaph, the son of Duel. Verse 21, somebody.
Then the Kohathites set out carrying the holy things. The tabernacle was to be set up before they arrived.
Okay. So you have the first three tribes set out, followed by the Gershonites and Merariites, who are carrying the structure of the tabernacle. Then the next three tribes, those on the south, set out, followed by the Kohathites, who are carrying the altar of incense, the Ark of the Covenant, and the most essential things, so that when they arrive wherever they're going, the Gershonites and Merariites would have set up the tabernacle, and it would all be ready for the holy things to be brought in and placed in place. Okay. Okay, verse 22, and the standard of the camp of the people of Ephraim set out by their companies, and over their company was Elishama, the son of Ammihud, and over the company of the tribe of the people of Manasseh was Gamaliel, the son of Pedazur, and over the company of the tribe of Benjamin was Abidan, the son of Gideoni. And these are the Rachel tribes. Should I just keep going since we got these names? Then, so that's the tribes from on the west. Then the tribes from on the north set out. Then the standard of the camp of the people of Dan, acting as the rear guard of all the camps, set out by their companies. And over their company was Ahiezer, the son of Amishadai. And over the company of the tribe of the people of Asher was Pagiel, the son of Okran. And over the company of the tribe of the people of Naphtali was Ahira, the son of Enan. Verse 28.
This was the order of march for the Israelite divisions as they set out.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So you got everything pictured in mind there. And they're heading to wherever they're going to go. There's one more little thing tossed in here that actually I had never noticed in my reading before. And Moses said to Hobab, the son of Reuel, the Midianite, Moses' father-in-law, also known as Jethro, we are setting out for the place of which the Lord said, I will give it to you. Come with us, and we will do good to you, for the Lord has promised good to Israel. Verse 30.
And he said to him, I will not go, but I will depart to my own land and to my relatives.
Mm-hmm. And he said, that is Moses said, and he said, please do not leave us, for you know where we should camp in the wilderness, and you will serve as eyes for us. Oh, really? That raises a question, but first, verse 32.
And if you do go with us, whatever good the Lord will do to us, the same will we do to you.
So why do they need him going with them? You know where we should camp, since it is God who will decide where they will stop.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you, Franz Bilich, who says that, what's his name again? Hobab, Moses' brother-in-law, Hobab, knew his way around that area, which means he knew where little streams were that were slightly off the path, where there might be hazards and there might be other things that they could take advantage of, trees growing where they could get some fruit, and on like that. familiarity with the land could be an advantage in their travels. And if only for that, it would be an advantage to have him. Because there are a lot of places, says Delitzsch, where off the way, there might be a hidden well where they could get water, or a stream that you would not notice from the main road. And very, very valuable.
Why did he feel like he wanted to leave?
To go back home? Because he wanted to go back home.
Okay, just...
And he declines to go, and then Moses asks a second time with some reason, and no more is said about that at that point. We are left to assume that he went, which happens to be confirmed later on when okay, Hobab. There's some space in between the two times where Delitzsch takes this up. Ah. Judges 1, verse 16. At the commencement of the period of the judges, the sons of the brother-in-law of Moses went into the desert of Judah to the south of Arad along with the sons of Judah. So, pretty certain that he did go along.
Did he wind up wandering in the wilderness for 40 years?
Good question. I don't
know. If I knew the wilderness area, and these people were under judgment, I think I would hightail it home.
Okay. Fortunately, we don't have to...
speculate?
We don't have to come to a definitive answer right now. Verse 33, then. So they set out from the Mount of the Lord, 3 days' journey. And the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord went before them 3 days' journey to seek out a resting place for them. Verse 34.
And the cloud of the Lord was over them by day whenever they set out from the camp.
Okay. So my assumption is that these 3 days, the cloud set out, settled at the end of the day, they camped overnight, and in the morning set out again and did that for those 3 days. And at the end of those 3 days, they came to a place where they could rest a little bit. It's traveling with all of your belongings, which is different from, oh, just a day's travel. And there we are. Verse 35. We find out what Moses announces at the beginning and at the end of the journeys. And whenever the ark set out, Moses said, "Arise, O Lord, and let your enemies be scattered, and let those who hate you flee before you." Verse 36.
And when it rested, he said, "Return, O Lord, to the many thousands of Israel."
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Uh-oh.
What's, uh-oh?
You froze.
Froze.
Did everybody? You're
frozen.
Who's
it's
frozen?
It's good for me. It's okay for me.
Yeah, me too. Okay. It's okay on my end.
Okay.
Yep. You too.
So it's the church.
Well, I can get out and go back in.
Moving, Deb.
Yeah.
Well.
So it's your signal.
And we just, when we freeze, we wait until we unfreeze. And move on.
Deb just froze.
Kind of like the traveling. Okay, Deb is frozen.
Is there a cloud over her computer?
I had to do my face like
that. There's a fog advisory, right?
Okay. That's time to get into trouble. And the people complained in the hearing of the Lord about their misfortunes. Say, what? Misfortunes?
They'd only been on the road 3 days.
Yeah, just wait. 40 years lies ahead.
And it's a short journey. It's 11 days journey. And then they're there. Are we there yet? Are we there yet? Yeah. So people complained in the hearing of the Lord about their misfortunes. And when the Lord heard it, his anger was kindled. And the fire of the Lord burned among them and consumed some outlying parts of the camp.
Yikes.
Yeah. And Dalit says, we are not to assume that it was only physical belongings that burned. Some people may have died in these fires. It is isolated outlying parts. And why are they outlying parts? Is this the people that did not want to be so much a part of this whole thing that they hung back from?
What were they considering their misfortunes at that time?
Yeah, exactly.
Everything? Just everything.
Well, we're about to find that out in about three verses. So verse 2.
Then the people cried out to Moses, and Moses prayed to the Lord, and the fire died down.
So the name of that place was called Taberah. Taberah means burning, because the fire of the Lord burned among them. Verse 4.
Now the rabble that was among them had a strong craving, and the people of Israel also wept again and said, oh, that we had meat to eat.
Yeah. Dalit kind of launches at this point.
Reminds me of my grandkids. We want macaroni and cheese. We want macaroni and cheese. We get macaroni and cheese, and said, they say, why don't we have hot dogs?
Yeah, there was a mob that had come out of Egypt along with the Israelites, the mixed multitude, rabble. By flesh, they missed. Not merely oxen, sheep, goats. Flesh generally is being better kind of food than the bread like manna. And then they're going to whine and they're going to whine and they're going to whine. So I'll leave the whining to when Dalich details a bit more of that. Verse 5, we remember the fish we ate in Egypt that cost nothing, the cucumbers, the melons, the leeks, the onions, and the garlic. Okay, there we are.
Of nothing but your servitude.
Yeah, well, the Nile was abundant in fish. And either you went and caught it or you got it for very cheap. Cucumbers, species differing from the ordinary cucumbers our day, distinguished for softness and sweet flavor. Watermelons were cultivated in immense quantities. Chives, onions which flourish better in Egypt than elsewhere and have a mild and pleasant taste. Garlic was a leading article of food. And they're saying they want strong and refreshing food that gives strength and power. Verse 6.
But now our whole being is dried up. There is nothing at all except this manna before our eyes.
Again, Dalich. Greediness longs for juicy and savory food. This is the perverted nature of man. Whoa. Going in. Now the manna was like coriander seed, and its appearance was like that of bdellium. Verse 8.
The people went around gathering it and then ground it in a handmill or crushed it in a mortar. They cooked it in a pot or made it into cakes, and it tasted like something made with olive oil.
Mm-hmm. Which is not bad.
Very tasty.
When the dew fell upon the camp in the night, the manna fell with it. Oh. Now he gives sweet, pastry-like food that gives sustenance. Verse 10.
Moses heard the people weeping throughout their clans, everyone at the door of his tent, and the anger of the Lord blazed hotly, and Moses was displeased.
Yeah, Moses is troubled by the complaining and by the impending wrath. There is no mention of any earlier manifestation of God's wrath than when it actually happens, but Dalich says, Moses can only have discovered a sign of the burning wrath of the Lord in the fact that although the discontent of the people burst forth in loud cries, God did not help but withdrew with his help and let the whole storm of the infuriated people burst upon him. We get some complaining from Moses next. Moses said to the Lord, "Why have you dealt ill with your servant, and why have I not found favor in your sight that you lay the burden of all this people on me?" You're going to hear echoes of parents. Verse 12.
Did I conceive all this people? Did I give them birth that you should say to me, carry them in your bosom as a nurse carries a nursing child to the land that you swore to give to their fathers?
Yeah. Is your son. Where am I to get meat to give to all this people? For they weep before me and say, give us meat that we may eat. Verse 14.
I am not able to bear all these people alone because the burden is too heavy for me.
Let me give a looser translation of verse 15. If you're going to treat me like this, kill me now.
What about all the sheep the livestock that they had with them?
Huh?
What about all the livestock that they had with them for sacrificing that? If they were supposed to give a tithing of that, where were the rest of the livestock? You know, why couldn't they eat those?
You ever try and feed a kid that doesn't want to like whatever it's given? We got grandkids. They're doing the same thing now. I don't want that. Well, how about I don't want that? How about I don't want that? Yeah. Go to bed without supper. Now, so kill me now, If I find favor in your sight, then I might not see my wretchedness. Okay, and now it's going to be somewhat of an interesting solution to Moses' actual complaint. And the complaint is an honest complaint. I can't do this. The burden of the office is too heavy. Verse 16.
Then the Lord said to Moses, gather for me 70 men of the elders of Israel, whom you know to be the elders of the people and officers over them, and bring them to the tent of meeting, and let them take their standard or their stand there with you.
Okay. Now toss in little details as they come to mind. And apparently, gathering around the tent of the meeting meant more of a semicircle around the entrance to the tent than encircling it. The 70 elders are not necessarily the same ones that went up on the mountain with Moses and Aaron, Nadab and Abihu. The number is the same, the people are not necessarily the same. And there is not a continuity between this and the Sanhedrin made up of 70 in the New Testament times, but there is a reserve council and court for Moses to turn to. And they continued on for some time.
Now, when did Jethro tell Moses to appoint?
That was on the way to Sinai.
On the way to Sinai.
And so that it was 70 and no, it wasn't 70. It was dividing up, dividing up, dividing up, dividing up.
Right.
This is not the same. Delitzsch just cautions. This is not the same. And all of those counts. But verse 17, and I will come down and talk with you there, and I will take some of the spirit that is on you and put it on them, and they shall bear the burden of the people with you, so that you may not bear it yourself alone. That's more kind than strict on God's part. Yeah. Verse 18.
And say to the people, consecrate yourselves for tomorrow, and you shall eat meat. For you have wept in the hearing of the Lord, saying, who will give us meat to eat? For it was better for us in Egypt. Therefore the Lord will give you meat, and you shall eat.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Don't eat.
Yeah. And the people were to consecrate themselves. This is a detour that most of you are not going to pick up on all of the details, but the word for consecrate is hith kadesh, from the root word kadosh, which means holy. It is a hith pael, which is a rare form of a Hebrew verb, not all that often used. When you see hith pael or hith hoel, that is somewhat of a poetic form. Interestingly, poetic form in the middle of this. Okay. Anyway. Verse 19, you shall not eat just 1 day or 2 days or 5 days or 10 days or 20 days. Verse You've been waiting for this verse, huh?
Yes.
Okay, go for it. Verse 20.
But for a whole month, until it comes out of your nostrils and you loathe it, because you have rejected the Lord who is among you and have wailed before him, saying, why did we ever leave Egypt? So there's your meat.
I'm sure some of them went, uh-oh.
Old oatmeal. Family story.
Yeah.
The family story of cold oatmeal. Okay, we grew up fairly poor in my house for a long time. breakfast was oatmeal. And because we didn't have much money, the rule was if you didn't eat your oatmeal for breakfast, you know how that does. It was lunch.
Oh.
If you didn't eat it for lunch, guess what?
Supper.
If you didn't eat it for supper, it was next morning's breakfast. And we didn't have microwaves back then, and you kind of choked down this cold oatmeal. This went on for a while until my older brother, Fred, saved the rest of us. There is a face that you make when you are rejecting your food, and it's like this. And if you force the food past that face that you're making, you will gag on it. And most of us gagged a bit and got it down. He saved us by one day, and it was not at breakfast. It was cold oatmeal later on. He spewed the whole bunch out of his stomach. Yeah. Came out his nostrils, and it was loathsome. And that was the end of cold oatmeal. Never again.
Thank you, Fred.
Yes. He doesn't remember it.
Oh.
And I walked into it. And never again cold oatmeal. Yeah.
So do you hate oatmeal now?
No. Okay. No, I learned to like it because when we went to seminary and then first call, money was scarce.
A lot of money.
And we learned how to fix oatmeal. And it was nourishing. And that was in the early 80s when I was out in Iowa, and it was part of the farm crisis. There were families of farmers who had oatmeal for two meals of the day, struggling to make ends meet. And it was hard times, hard times.
Oh, really?
But God has the right to take this personally after he's brought them into freedom and bringing them to a land flowing with milk and honey and all kinds of good things, and they're complaining the whole way.
And it's an 11-day journey, for goodness sakes, people.
I mean,
when you travel, you take along pemmican or whatever. You take along beef jerky and eat that. Eat whatever you can.
And they may not be eating the livestock they brought along with, because they're going to a land that will have all kinds of pasture and everything else.
Oh, hi, Norma. You got your camera.
I've been hitting buttons the whole time, and I finally got the right one, I guess.
Well, verse 21. But Moses said, the people among whom I am number 600,000 on foot, and you have said, I will give them meat that they may eat a whole month. Verse 22.
Shall flocks and herds be slaughtered for them and be enough for them? Or shall all the fish of the sea be gathered together for them and be enough for them?
And the Lord said to Moses, is the Lord's hand shortened? Now you shall see whether my word will come true for you or not. Huh. Verse 24.
So Moses went out and told the people the words of the Lord. And he gathered 70 men of the elders of the people and placed them around the tent.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Then the Lord came down in the cloud and spoke to him and took some of the spirit that was on him and put it on the 70 elders. And as soon as the spirit rested on them, they prophesied, but they did not continue doing it. And there's a couple points there. First off, does this decrease the spirit that is on Moses? Delitzsch uses the example of fire. A burning stick, when you put other sticks with it and they catch fire, they draw their fire from that stick, but does it decrease the original? No. It increases and enriches. So the Holy Spirit is not decreased upon Moses, but by being spread to the 70, it strengthens and increases. The Spirit strengthens and increases his effects. And so the 70 elders then gathering around, and they prophesy. What is meant by them prophesying? And a lot of the more modern commentaries will talk about ecstatic utterances where you fall down and you're speaking in strange words that don't make sense to those around you. But I remind you that the word prophecy in the Bible means speaking the word of the Lord. That is not necessarily about things to come, but speaking the word of the Lord. And then I made a marginal note. There is consistency in the word, and that is one of the ways that you know that it is prophecy, is the consistency back and forth between those who are prophesying. So for example, Paul and Ananias in Damascus, each are given half of the prophecy. And when they come together, Paul recognizes that God has told him about a man named Ananias. And Ananias, coming to Paul, knows that he is sent by God to Paul. Peter and Cornelius, the one gets a prophecy and the other a vision. It is a confirming connection. Moses and Aaron. As Moses is heading back to Egypt, he's told by God that Aaron is coming out to meet him. As Aaron comes out to meet him, then they know that it is God who is arranging these things. And the greatest example of this, of course, is Mary and Joseph, who are independently told what the name of the child will be. It's a confirming aspect for the prophesying. And so speaking the word of God in some manner that is recognized by the other as, this is the revelation that I also was given, has a confirming aspect. And I would suggest that in the absence of evidence to the contrary, this is how we should take these examples of prophesying as a confirmation of the Spirit of God being upon, well, the elders and upon Moses. They recognize in the other and in what the other is saying what has been revealed to them. And that is very simply a regular occurrence in the Bible. God does not expect us to simply wing it and assume that the revelation that we have is valid. He does things to confirm the revelation. Hope that makes sense. Mm-hmm. And then the 70 did not continue doing this. It was a one-time thing for establishing the reality of it.
My Bible has a footnote for that says, or prophesied and continued to do so.
Yeah, the
Hebrew is ambiguous. Very contradictory.
The Hebrew is the same thing. The Hebrew is ambiguous partly because there is a word that Lamed Aleph, lo. which can either mean yes or no. Depends on the context.
Huh.
Why did they make a language like that where the same two letters, right, yes and no? I don't understand.
And maybe because it's not important whether they did or didn't.
It's to keep us humble. But around this whole text, there's a lot of Jewish rabbis asking that question, and their conclusion almost to a man is, did not continue.
Mm.
And so if you're going to go with something, flip a coin and go with that one. But we get to verse 26.
However, two men whose names were Eldad and Medad had remained in the camp. They were listed among the elders, but did not go out to the tent. Yet the Spirit also rested on them, and they prophesied in the camp.
Ah.
Huh.
Why did they not go out? Yeah. There's always a skeptic or two.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe something happened. But interestingly enough, it did not depend on them being in the presence of Moses to have this happen. So this was given not by Moses, but by God.
Mm-hmm.
And it ends up being another confirming aspect. However, and a young man ran and told Moses, Eldad and Medad are prophesying in the camp. Verse 28.
So Joshua, the son of Nun, Moses' assistant, one of his choice men, answered and said, Moses, my Lord, forbid them.
Yeah, like when the disciples told Jesus that there was somebody preaching in Jesus' name, and Jesus said, I'm doing miracles in his name, and Jesus said, and they said to Jesus, we've tried to stop him. And Jesus said, don't forbid him, because who does anything good in my name and then speaks ill about me? And he who is not against us is with us. There's a refusal to be jealous. And so verse 29, but Moses said to him, are you jealous for my sake? Would that all the Lord's people were prophets, and that the Lord would put his Spirit on them. Verse 30, and then a comment.
And Moses and the elders of Israel returned to the camp.
Okay. It would come later that God would promise that he would put his Spirit on all his people. That would be in Jeremiah 31, 31 to 34. And write his law on our hearts and forgive our sins. And so having all of us having the Spirit of God, all God's people are prophets. What happens when a confirmation kid stands up and speaks the word of God? I call that prophesying, because they are telling the gospel of the Lord. When our kids do the Christmas program, hopefully we will resume after this whole mess.
Yeah, I missed that.
And they recite the verses. What are they doing?
Prophecy.
Mm-hmm. All God's people. And it is what Peter said in Acts chapter 2. God promised, I will put my Spirit on you, and your sons and daughters will prophesy, and your old men will dream dreams, and your young men will see visions. Do you want to do the sick part?
Yeah.
Very quickly. Then a wind from the Lord sprang up, and it brought quail from the sea and let them fall beside the camp, about a day's journey on this side and a day's journey on the other side around the camp, and about 2 cubits above the ground. Think of it like snowdrifts, that there were mounds that were 2 cubits high, not everywhere being that height, but mounds of it.
And a dead quail?
Yeah. The quail in that area migrate from Africa northward, and they migrate over the sea. But here's a strong wind that drives them inland into the desert. There's no water, there's no food for them there, and the quail are exhausted. Delitzsch talks about going, flying along about, 10 feet high. They're exhausted and flying low, and it's possible to catch them, or you just wait for them to drop from exhaustion. 32.
All that day and night and all the next day, the people went out and gathered quail. No one gathered less than 10 homers. Then they spread them out all around the camp.
Okay, a homer is about 2 bushels. Delitzsch says a Dresden bushel. And so 20 Dresden. Do you guys old enough to remember the size of a bushel basket? Mm-hmm. I remember carrying leaves in a bushel basket as my parents raked. And so I know the size. It's like that by about that. So 20 bushel baskets. And what you do with them is you spread the quail out, spread them out to dry, like they did in Egypt with fish. Okay. While the meat was yet between their teeth, before it was consumed, the anger of the Lord was kindled against the people, and the Lord struck down the people with a very great plague. Yeah. Verse 34.
Therefore, the place was named Kibroth Hattaavah, because they were buried there. They buried the people who had craved other food.
Kibroth Hattaavah means graves of craving.
Graves of craving.
It was graves of craving. Yeah. And then from Kibroth Hattaavah, the people journeyed to Hazeroth, and they remained at Hazeroth. So they're going to camp there for a little while. We have one more chapter before sending spies into Canaan, which is interesting because it's not even 3 chapters from leaving Sinai to Canaan after almost 2 books worth.